I didn't have the microphone close, but now I do. All right, so this afternoon we're hearing two family law cases. The first one is Bird v. Bird, Kelly Bird and Cody Bird. We have the appellant is Kelly and represented by Mr. Hunt. And this is through the pro bono program. Okay, all right, we're very thankful for you to be here and willing to take this case on. And so you'll go first, Mr. Hunt. Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I reserve
2 minutes. 2 minutes? Okay, you're more realistic than most people. They usually say five and end up with two. All right, and then we have Mr. Friedman, and you're joined also by your colleagues. You want to introduce them?
My associates, Gary Siebel and Anthony Smith.
Anthony
Smith.
Smith, okay.
Very complicated
last name. All right, thank you also, Mr. Smith and Mr. Siegel, for being here, too. All right, so Mr. Hunt, go ahead.
Good afternoon. The Honorable Justice of the Court, esteemed colleagues and opposing counsel, members of the gallery. This case is a classic example. More often than not, moms can neither prosecute or defend their cases themselves in a divorce action because of the lack of resources, regardless of the good intentions of sergeant versus sergeant. In these too often circumstances, moms are at such a disadvantage, one has to ask the question, why is it that a husband rarely, if ever, loses his representation during the course of litigation due to financial hardship, as is usually the case with mom, as was such the case here? Even though both parties are supposed to be equal in financial position during and after the divorce. Why is it that husbands so often after the divorce rise like the phoenix from the ashes so their financial position becomes way better and also leaves moms in a destitute position usually to fend for herself and her children? Why is it that husbands, after these divorces, after a trial, where the moms could not defend themselves because of lack of resources and losing their counsel, why is that? The answer is that the family courts too often do not properly exercise the discretion that they have, nor do they apply the law, or they attempt to apply the law in a cookie-cutter fashion to decide issues of child custody, child support, and the division of separate community debts and assets. Again, such was the case in this matter. Knowing that my time is limited, it will be impossible for me to cover the six-inch issues that are in this case. And all that Kelly can do is rely upon you as justices to look at that voluminous record that we gave, as well as the law and citing whether it was the abuse of discretion or an inappropriate application of the law.
Mr. Hunt, do you believe that part of the problem in this case is the imputed income to Kelly?
Yes, Your Honor. Which may be, it's very good that you hit on that, because it may be the domino that makes all of the inequities fall on moms who are trying to raise their children. Because, again, at the end, I can't tell you, and I practice family law forever, right, that all of a sudden, because, as in this case, the appellee got the business, and in this case, since then, he purchased $500,000 house, and in this case, he's expanded his business five times over.
You better stick to I
will.
In the rest.
So I'm going to go as fast as I can.
Yeah.
So,
are you going to be here for the next argument on our other family law case?
No, I'm not.
Okay. It's much different perspective presented on that one from the mom's side.
Okay.
From the dad's side.
And I understand that. But again, I think I would be remiss if I didn't say the general applicability of these financial disadvantages usually fall on moms.
And we don't make gender-based decisions.
Well, I understand.
What the facts are and what the law is and try and apply it as equal as possible.
Exactly. Exactly. But I also think that in doing that, especially the family court, because they are empowered with such discretion, that they need to exercise that in the realities of what happens to these families before and after the divorce.
Mr. Hunt, I do have a question related to the tax returns, and I just want to confirm. It's my understanding that the most recent tax return was a 2016 return. Was that the return utilized by the court to determine whether or
not? The one for $174,000, I do believe that is the case, Your Honor.
Are you disputing the use of the 2016 tax return?
Well, that was the problem, Your Honor, that instead of applying that tax return, they accepted the affidavit of financial condition of $10,000 a month, which is far less than what was on the tax return.
So your position, obviously, is the tax return should have been used and it should have been the 2016 tax return.
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe that.
Thank you.
And one of the other things I would ask of the court to consider, which is unusual in making these decisions, is that lots of times when we have family law cases and we apply this abuse of discretion standard, which I know is very difficult. It's almost like if that's the case, I should sit out. But that's not the case in the sense that if you do decide to give Kelly any relief, I would hope that you do it with specific orders, because saying, example, that you did not include the two factors in Brunzell, well, here's what happens. The reality of that is you go back down to family court, you go to a hearing, they go, okay, now I have considered those two things, I affirm my ruling. You win to lose. And that is a tragedy. And that is, and if you look at where people are left financially and families are left, the huge difference, and I am going to say it is generally a gender-based thing, where the husband puts himself in the position to move on with his life, but the court hands, as you said, Your Honor, you know, we're supposed to be blind, we're not gendered, but at the same token, when you look at that situation, what the final reality of what happens to these cases after, and I'm doing this on a pro bono case because I do believe that the exercise of discretion should be one to take into consideration the totality of the family and not be a cookie cutter and say, okay, you're the husband, we're going to impute income, like on the imputing of income. It's supposed to be willful. They presented no evidence that she had willfully been unemployed and yet imputed $30,000 to her. She had been a stay-at-home mom for 13 years, raised those children, gave up her career to be in that position, and now she's in her middle 50s and she's supposed to march out and get a job for $30,000 a year? In this world, not happening.
It certainly would. Certainly would be difficult, no doubt about it, but didn't the judge caution her at the beginning of the case that that's what she'd be looking for, and so you better do something rather than just hope you're going to win and you don't have to go to work?
No, and I respectfully would tell you, Your Honor, that those admonitions that are in the record was for her to do that, but she never felt and never stated, as required by the statute, that if you're going to impute income to somebody, you have to show that failure to go out and get a job, failure to do those things, has to be willful. That's not in the record. It's not in any record anywhere. So, and again, the domino effects of this thing comes down because if you make an error, right, as a court, in deciding what the prospective income levels are of the people, right, then that domino included the alimony, that domino included child support, and that's why. And if you look at, if we're going to say she had to go to court, improper person against skillful attorneys, right, and to go into court and then have that where it's a disadvantage.
Well, what do you think is the most problematic ruling of the district court that you've raised on appeal?
Well, I think there's two things. Because I know what's the most important and more dear to her than anything are her children. The pure fact of the matter is that the court violated the statute by not applying the presumption that the domestic violence in the case needed to decide whether to determine whether they're sole or whether there is joint custody. The record was clear, even through a layperson's attempt to present it, right? The police were there, his parental rights were terminated in a prior situation. So all these things were in play, but the court just sui sponte ignored them. And so I know that that's problem, because the most important thing is her children. And to not
well,
have
the court,
court didn't ignore
the presumption. The court didn't find the facts that were the predicate to apply the presumption. How are we supposed to deal with that when it's an issue of clear and convincing evidence and the court heard it and made its own decision?
Because the court didn't address that in the record. The court did not address the presumption and the statutory presumption in the record to make a record to make that conclusion. It's not there. It's not there.
So the absence of a finding then you're talking about.
Yes, Your Honor, and because that's the law. And if that presumption would have been in play, or she would have considered it in based upon the attempt of the improper person doing it, then I think that it would have been part of the record, and it is not. So you're asking me, what's the most important thing? But I would say, again...
Right, but a lot of times we say the absence means there's an implied finding of a denial.
Sure, I understand that. But if you go and again... You are in the best position to mete out justice. People come to tug on your ropes because they believe that you'll look deep in that. So if you look into the record that was presented about domestic violence, you can reasonably come to the conclusion that the termination of his parental rights, the domestic violence that occurred in it, was not properly taken into consideration, and therefore the judge's exercise of giving joint custody was an abuse of discretion.
All right, what's your other
The next one is just like I said, the domino effect. The domino effect of this income, because first of all, his income was not properly taken into account. He did a financial affidavit disclosure, and it's just not indicative of what he made. It probably isn't what he has now. But the bottom line is that caused the child support thing to be misapplied. It also caused the alimony to be misapplied. Also, there's obviously the statute, the presumption that the court has to equally divide all the assets and the debts to put the people in as much parity as possible is not properly taken into consideration regarding the valuation of the business. And I would ask the court to look at the record, right, and see if that, when looking at the record, because this idea of abuse of discretion, failure to properly exercise discretion, I don't mean to be flippant, it's like, you know, what Justice Potter said, it's like pornography. I know it when I see it. And I think that if you look at the record and you drill down into the record, you'll see that there was an abuse of discretion. That doesn't mean that Judge Gentile had malice or anything of that nature. But they work hard. I know. I'm down there. It's a jungle. And when you're there, right, they're in that position where they have to process people. But in the case, when you get right down to it, are families not more important than a contract? Are families not important than a lease? I would submit it is. And that's why it's even more important that the record's intact.
Mr. Hunt, regarding the evaluation of the insurance business, the judge did utilize one of the factors in the range, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I would have to absolutely acknowledge that.
Thank you.
All right, you're at just under 2 minutes now.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Save that time.
I didn't see it. Oh, what? I'm sorry if I ran over in that mic, because I only wanted two. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, it's the respondents. turn for Cody Bird, and Mr. Friedman is making the argument. A lot of different topics were covered in the opening. I don't know if they were the ones you expected, but there was a lot there. But it's your choice of how to respond to it.
Your Honor, may it please the Court, counsel for the appellant, Cody D. Bird, who's present in the courtroom here today. And you're correct. There were a number of issues touched upon, but I think it may be illustrative and helpful to this Court to take a little bit of a step back and let's go at 10,000 feet. I think that when we look at Judge Gentile's 29-page findings of fact and conclusions of law, I think what we find is she's heeding the body of case law coming out of our Supreme Court and out of Your Honor's courtroom. I think she's finding, I think that she's making findings with specificity. I think that those findings are supported by substantial evidence, and I think she's undertaking, as I will explain in a moment, a detailed analysis. And I think that's the core part of what Your Honor should be looking at. This isn't a hand-waving at a legal phrase like best interest and then a conclusion. She's giving you a factor-by-factor-based analysis of the best interest factors, and then more than that, she's explaining how each of those factors weighed upon her thinking, wherein certain factors perhaps she deemed to be neutral, why she deemed them neutral, where a factor weighed in favor of one of the litigants, how it did so, and then ultimately making an ultimate global finding supported by substantial evidence as required, and then tying that finding to a conclusion of law. And she's doing exactly what the body of case law is requiring her.
Except for one thing. What about the
domestic violence? I'm giving you 10,000 feet. I'm going to go into some detail, Your Honor, if I may. I think with regard, if we were starting with domestic violence, to state that her analysis is contained nowhere in the record, I cannot find the same summation, to be clear, when I review the record. Page 17, line 16 of her findings of fact and conclusions of law. She engages. She talks about the various pieces of both testimony and evidence that she looked at. She talks about how she had two problems. First and foremost, she was unable to discern whether, in fact, an act or acts of domestic violence occurred. She explains why. She then talks about to the extent that perhaps one did, or ones or several did. She was unable to determine the primary aggressor. And as a result, she's left with a neutral finding. She's unable to, A, use the factor in a way to determine best interest, and certainly doesn't find clear and convincing evidence to trigger, as Your Honor pointed out, what would have been a rebuttable presumption under the factor. And I think that it's important to note, and this is where I'll back up again a bit, if I take appellant at the face value of their appeal, they're really talking about should versus could, right? So they're telling you that she should have done certain things. But really what they're saying is they think she could. If she would have grabbed this specific piece of evidence or that specific piece of evidence and perhaps given it more weight, then they could have come to a decision that appellant preferred. The issue is, as to abuse of discretion, they fail to say how she couldn't do what she did given the evidence, how the evidence that she did choose to weigh and the merit that she put to those pieces of evidence couldn't support such that a reasonable jurist would agree with her. And I think to the contrary, so by the absence of that argument, I think supports the contention that there was substantial evidence to support these findings. I understand appellant doesn't enjoy those findings. They aren't consistent with what she desired. I practice almost exclusively in family law, and unfortunately, it's a reality every day for my clients. They don't always love the way judges go about in their ruminations as jurists weighing pieces of evidence, but that is soundly within their discretion. That is precisely what the body of case law tells Your Honors you must allow them to do. You're not here to stand as judge over how they weigh the piece
well,
of evidence.
You structured your argument this way. You get the 10,000-foot view. What is all the evidence, and what could the district court have done from that evidence, right? But when you dive down to the deeper level, you can't apply the substantial evidence test to a finding unless there is a finding, especially when at the 10,000-foot level, there's conflicting evidence. The judge could have gone this way, the judge could have gone the other way. Okay. Which way did the judge go? And so at the micro level, if the evidence supports any ruling the district judge should have made, then you have to look at what did the district judge conclude.
Sure.
So here's my question. I'm looking at the finding now, this lengthy finding on Kelly's employment.
Sure.
And she says, a court cannot find that Kelly is capable of earning $8,000 a year, but it's reasonable to impute the sum of $30,000 a year for income. But the test of willful unemployment, you have to at least use the word willful or purposely or something like that in there. And if they don't use that word, then how do we determine whether or not the evidence would support the finding when there is no finding there?
I think that's a bit of a red herring, and I understand why Your Honor might have gone for that. The Minier decision would have told you that in order to find willful unemployment, the court needed to make that finding. I don't believe that's what the court did.
I think the court was applying Rosenbaum, and I think what the court was saying is under Rosenbaum, the court can impute income where you have two things, an affirmative action by basically an obligor, and you have lack of good faith. And she found both of those. She found that mom had, in fact, ignored an admonishment to get work and had consistently done so. That was the affirmative action. And then Judge Gentile finds that that failure to adhere to the admonishment was not in good faith. Okay, and I would buttress it that point. So I think that Mueller distracts the court away from the true heart of the analysis, which is Rosenbaum, and I do believe it was accurate there. But I would also buttress it with under 125-150 for the alimony analysis, the court was forced to make findings about pre-divorce earnings, the financial condition resulting from the divorce, and what was her employability going forward. That there was an absence of employment, despite the admonishment, didn't stop Judge Gentile from having to make those findings. And then I think if you look at how did she make those findings, she certainly relied on substantial evidence in doing so. She considered the appellant's pre-divorce employment, her education, her earnings, and more to the fact, respondent, my client sought an imputation of somewhere around $100,000 a year based upon historical wages. And that was not at all what the judge found. The judge ultimately weighed all of the evidence and chose to highlight, and that's where I come back to I apologize again for using the metaphor, 10,000-foot view, because she chose to say, well, I'm going to agree that there should be an imputation of some kind. She is able-bodied and can work and needs to. However, I'm not going to, wholeheartedly take down all of respondents' suggestions about what her income could or should be. I'm going to actually mitigate. She has a lack of an understanding of the technology at issue that will inhibit her. She hasn't been in the workforce for 7 years. All of these are robust and substantive findings to support, give you insight as judge into her analysis and ultimately into the finding. So again, I think she was pretty right on the money there with regard to the decision. I thought it was exemplary. Talking about fees, just for a moment, because I know it was addressed, was sort of the start of this. I note a couple things. I note that there were sergeant fees awarded in this case and paid, preliminary fees, which is very common. I also note that the issue ultimately of attorney's fees is not on appeal before your honors. I know that it was briefed, but I think you'll note that the order pursuant to the invitation from the court for 54 briefing on attorney's fees was issued in September. There was no appeal taken from that.
All right, that's pretty evident.
So that's just sort of a moot issue, I think, as far as we stand here today. With regard to the physical custody provisions, again, I think in terms of accord with the case law, this could not have been a more robust analysis. It's a factor-by-factor analysis with specific attention paid to wherein a bit of testimony or a bit of evidence may have applied to a factor, and then how the court went about weighing those, and ultimately the findings which resulted, which is what you're after. Your honors are tasked here with seeing was an abuse of discretion carried out. No, this was a sound exercise of judicial discretion.
Mr. Friedman, when I look at the issue of imputed income, I am somewhat concerned about the Manure decision.
Okay.
Can you distinguish it in terms of why it should not be applied to determining child custody support?
Well, I would argue first and foremost, as to child support, it's a distinction without difference in this particular case. Because ultimately, the calculation of child support under the regulation as it exists currently and will exist through the 1st of February would have been exactly the same with or without the imputation. The respondent was capped. So quite literally, in terms of that decision itself, whether the judge, I believe rightfully, did impute the $30,000 pursuant to Rosenbaum, which allows you to do it for both alimony and child support, and that decision is pretty clear in that regard. Whether she did or did not for the purposes of child support, it was exactly the same calculation. And I do note the court never said, pursuant to 125B050, or subsection 8, 080, excuse me, that it was due to willful underemployment, there was an imputation. The court simply said they were going to find mom had the ability to earn a wage. And I think it was really, in my view, more about consistency of the decision. Because we were imputing income for the purposes of her post-decree standard, for the purposes of alimony, to do it across the board and say, this is what we believe mom's imputed income should be. And I do think it bears noting, not to repeat the statement, but it didn't factor in the calculation. At point of fact, the imputation, when you run the right Osborne calculation, it had no bearing. That was capped. Hope that answers Your Honor's question.
Thank you.
Right, and Manure's for child support, not alimony.
It is correct, whereas Rosenbaum applies to both. And I think, in point of fact, the fact that the court didn't, to answer Your Honor's question, didn't state willful underemployment speaks to where she was going, speaks to the Rosenbaum imputation as opposed to...
Even, I understand, you know, there is obviously a difference between Meniere and Rosenbaum, but even, you know, even if the judge is not going for Meniere to willful underemployment for the purposes of evading a child support obligation,
sure.
Rosenbaum still has the word purposely in it. In other words, the reason you impute the income versus, yeah, as opposed to using the actual income, is she is, yeah, it's not willful in the sense of Meniere, but it's still purposely, you're making less than you should have, and that's why you're imputing, and so it goes back to your question, was if we don't know if she's using purposely or willful or any other word, what's the finding that we're judging against the substantial evidence?
I think if you'll, I tried to address this, and obviously you could jump. Let me try and address it again. I think what Rosenbaum required is both an affirmative action mm-hmm. on behalf of the obligor, in this case, mom, because it was a joiner, it was either in alimony context because she's there and the factors need to be weighed, or because she's a joint custodian in the court, case of child support. The affirmative action was ignoring the court's admonishment. And Judge Antilli makes that very clear.
I understand that, but here's the point. The fact that you're trying to fill in what she said, is it willful or is it purposely, right? You're saying, well, there's no finding willful, so it must be purposely, but she's not using either word. What is she doing? Are we doing Meniere or are we doing Rosenbaum?
In candor to the court, I believe from my review of the record that she uses the words, failed to follow my admonishment, and then she says that failure was not in good faith. And both good faith and the affirmative action are the two prongs of Rosenbaum. So in my view, I don't know that I'm gap-filling. I understand you're going to be filled. I believe that pretty clearly what she's stating is, once the admonishment was made, mom needed to do that. Now, you suggested the actual, why wasn't she using the actual income? And I would submit that is the point of Rosenbaum. She wasn't able to use the actual figures.
If there's a purpose, right? It may not be willful under Meniere, but it still has to be some, I mean, that's what Rosenbaum says, purposely earns less than a reasonable capabilities permit.
Right. Well, I would suggest, I guess, that on its face, once admonished to find work and a failure to do so throughout the pendency of the action, which was quite long, much like Meniere, to argue my analogy, wherein they find once the preponderance is met that you can find that it was for the purposes of waiting, you can find that once you've not you've complied with my admonishment, now there has to be some purpose, right? And so clearly, and again, I don't find that Judge found it to be punitive. In fact, when you look at how she analyzed those facts, she actually was quite deferential. She actually sought out and used, I think, aptly so, a lot of the appellant's statements relative to her difficulty finding work, relative to the technology which had passed her by and that potentially would make it difficult for her to earn at her historical level, despite having an MBA, despite having historically earned a six-figure salary, and found something far less as a reasonable imputation under Rosenbaum.
Do you think that what appears to have happened is that Ms. Bird thought she was going to get primary custody, therefore she didn't follow the admonishment, because if she ended up with custody, she would have the children and wouldn't be able to work like the judge had admonished her to do. And she wrongly calculated that she was going to win the custody battle with her having primary when it ended up joint.
Those types of logical sequencing I would leave to the capable hands of your honors. I would not suggest to know.
I don't know. I'm just saying from the closer view of the case.
It does seem reasonable, perhaps, that there was some, you know, thought behind it.
That there was domestic violence, so the presumption would be applied, and therefore she'd end up with custody.
Really unfortunate if that was the case. I think that the record on appeal would show that during the pendency, the court had shown a propensity of working towards joint physical custody, that obviously you had both, as to legal custody, you know, a presumption of joint legal, and then you have a preference toward joint physical, and the court was pretty clear in its articulation of both of those. So it would be unfortunate if appellant did, in fact, rely on that hope or the thought that that would come to fruition. Obviously, in this case, it did not. But I don't believe it changes the core of Your Honor's matters, which is this, and I'll probably leave a little time on the clock unless Your Honor's have questions, is we task our judges with making these type of sound discretionary decisions every day. And again, I think that when we look at an exemplary record, a 29-page finding of fact conclusion of law prepared by our judge in this case, and the painstaking analysis undertaken to show not only the specific factor-based analysis, but the weighing, the judicial philosophy that's underpinning those findings, and then tying those out carefully to conclusions of law, this is precisely the type of decision I think that the Supreme Court, and I would suggest Your Honors, are suggesting you want to see in all of these cases. I think it would be exemplary. And I think, again, I'm not insensitive to appellant's position. I have had clients in that position a number of times, but it does not mean it wasn't a sound exercise.
Well, appellant started this out with the 10,000-foot view that, hey, there's bias against women in the system.
I would respectfully disagree. Would you like me to elaborate, Your Honor?
You probably appear in all the family courts here, right?
I do.
And everyone's a little different.
This is correct. But that, nonetheless, it doesn't mean an exercise of judicial discretion was abused here, right? I would submit to you, just because three of our, what will be, what, in next election cycle, 26 judges might have grabbed on different pieces of evidence or testimony and might have weighed them differently, does not rise to the level of an abuse of discretion. It's not even respectfully close or in the ballpark.
Mr. Friedman, are we concerned at all that the 2016 tax return was not utilized in this case?
I know I'm a little over. Can I answer the question?
Go ahead.
I'm not, for two reasons. First and foremost, the 2016 return was used. What's supplemented in the record is actually a 2017 tax return, which was not part of the trial court's record. I think it got into this record in error. Second answer is, if you look at the actual finding Judge Gentile makes, she uses the word taxable income. And I think had Your Honors had the complete record and seen, as you would have seen, the analysis that I believe she undertook was as to the taxable income in each of the years, which does mirror almost identically the number that she used for Mr. Bird's income. And I think that's the discrepancy. She wasn't using total income. She wasn't using AGI. She was using taxable income, particularly when balancing on spousal support because of the tax implications which existed then that don't under our current tax law now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Does that fully answer that question? Okay. All right, Mr. Hunt, two more, or a minute and 51 seconds, actually.
First, Your Honor, what I meant by the bias, the historical bias, I said generally that is applied on to burdens by women. I think that whether you're a man or a woman and you're in that position where you're stay-at-home and you've stayed for years and years and the other one's outside the one with the economic where-for-all, in the end, there's a gross inequity, whether a man or a woman. One of the things about the, I'm going to be quick, one of the things about the domestic violence, if you look at the record, that was also supported by the way the judge literally started visitation, one day a week. All those things were in play. I also want to talk about Muneer. It says, but when the district court hears evidence of willful unemployment, a rebuttable presumption arises. One of the things that's really important is that the district court did not make a finding Kelly intentionally failed to find a job or hold a job below her reasonable level of skill or purposefully earns less than her reasonable capabilities permit. Under Lewis, Hicks versus Lewis, as stated clearly, we have consistently found error where the trial court invented its own formula for calculating support awards. And I assume that it's said in the plural to mean both child support and spousal support.
Well, but I think his argument is this. Willful, you know, Rosenbaum and Muneer have this interaction, you know, there has to be it's purposely under Rosenbaum, but it has to be a higher standard of willful under Muneer. And because the district judge didn't use the words willful or any words like it, and the district court didn't use the word purposely either, but it used words a lot closer to purposely than willful. Therefore, by inference, it didn't find willful and did find something more or less like purposely under Rosenbaum. I think that's his argument, that the omission of the record is the finding.
I understand, Your Honor.
And do you have a response to that?
I still believe that in looking at the totality of the position of both people and the law, the intent of the law was, whether it's purposeful or intentional, was to put the people in a position that before you then start applying imputing income to somebody, it's done in a manner that allows everybody to be on equal footing.
Okay, thank you very much,
Thank
Mr.
you.
Hunt.
Thank you.
This matter will be taken under advisement. We'll have a written decision in the near future. We want to thank Mr. Hunt again and your law firm.